if Canada delays or refuses to extradite Ms. Meng, Huawei, the company, will be put on trial in the United States.
Will Huawei interfere with the renewed U.S.-China trade talks? We'll delve into that. This is Thursday, the 31st of January, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, the U.S. president is not happy with what his intelligence service leaders told his Senate panel. Another sign of possible progress in talks with the Taliban about Afghanistan, all on VOA Asia. Top U.S. and Chinese trade officials returned to the bargaining table Wednesday in Washington, working to avoid a sharp escalation in the trade war between the world's two largest economies. Chinese Vice Premier Liu He is leading Beijing's delegation to the talks, with just a month remaining and a 90-day truce declared in December. The talks also occur against the backdrop of Washington's sweeping prosecution of Chinese telecom giant Huawei, which has outraged Beijing and infused the negotiations with uncertainty. Should the talks fail, U.S. import duties on $200 billion in Chinese imports are due to more than double on March 2nd, something economists say could help knock the wind out of global economy sales. A final agreement seemed even more distant Monday after the U.S. Justice Department announced two indictments of the Chinese telecommunication giant Huawei on charges of stealing trade secrets, fraud, obstruction of justice, and of a top executive accused of violating U.S. sanctions on Iran. That followed the arrest of Huawei executive in Canada at the request of the United States. But U.S. officials insist that trade talks and Huawei prosecutions are not related. I spoke with Julian Koo, the law professor at New York's Hofstra University and the faculty director of international programs there. He agreed with the U.S. officials.
So far, there hasn't been any indication that that either side, meaning U.S. or China, has tried to bring that into connect the two different issues. In other words, the United States has actually said that this is separate from, it's not a trade issue. This is a law enforcement, criminal law issue. And so it's not something you can trade for. And China has also not publicly linked those two things. At least in their public statements, they haven't said this is something the United States should stop prosecuting because of trade reasons. I think so far, both sides have been pretty clear that they want to keep it on a separate track.
However, the president of the United States early on said that maybe there could be some kind of relationship between the two when it comes to an effect on the U.S.-China trade talks.
You're right. And so the one exception to this has been comments made by President Trump shortly after Ms. Meng was detained in Canada. His statements, it was a little bit unclear because it was in response to a question, and he didn't make any definitive statements, but he said, sure, I'd consider it, maybe if that makes everyone happier or something. It was something very general and abstract like that. So it's possible, therefore, that has sort of raised the possibility that the U.S. might be willing to trade. However, the one thing I would just say since then is that there was a period after Ms. Meng was detained and before the U.S. sent its formal request for extradition when it would have been easier for the U.S. to withdraw its request or not file the criminal indictment or to withdraw the indictment. And it would have been much easier to do so anytime between, say, December 1st and yesterday when they actually filed the formal request for extradition. So if they wanted to pull it, they could have done so during that time. So it's interesting that they haven't done so. They went ahead and made the formal request, and also they unsealed their indictments. So I think it would be much harder for the U.S. now to take up President Trump's suggestion and withdraw those charges as part of a trade deal.
So what comes next? What is your read of both incidents?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear the U.S. government, especially the Department of Justice, is fully committed to going forward with this, with these criminal charges against Ms. Meng and against Huawei, the company. So even if Canada delays or refuses to extradite Ms. Meng, Huawei, the company, will be put on trial in the United States, and they'll have some sort of proceeding. So I think that I would be very surprised if those indictments were withdrawn because they made a really big deal out of announcing those indictments. My expectation is that it will not be something that will be mentioned or discussed or bargained for in the trade negotiations.
I spoke with Julian Ku on Skype last year. U.S. sanctions on another Chinese telecom company, ZTE, sent waves through the trade negotiations, which produced no breakthrough. President Donald Trump later intervened to modify the penalties, allowing ZTE to avoid collapse. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. China's largest employer said Wednesday it's shifting away from construction of a mammoth electronics factory in the United States. Two people are dead after a grenade attack on a mosque in the southern Philippines Wednesday, the second deadly attack on a religious site in the region after a landmark referendum approving an autonomous Muslim region. The Pakistani Taliban is claiming responsibility for an attack on a police facility where at least 9 were killed and 21 injured. Afghan special forces freed dozens from Taliban captivity in southeastern Ghazni province earlier this week, according to Afghan officials talking with VOA. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our website at voanews.com. We continue on VOA Asia. America's intelligence chiefs have warned of a dizzying array of security threats the United States faces across the globe. Among the conclusions unveiled at a Senate hearing Tuesday, North Korea is unlikely to completely give up all of its nuclear stockpiles, and Iran is technically in compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal, both points contradicting key tenets of President Donald Trump's foreign policy. VOA's Michael Bowman reports from the Senate, where lawmakers of both parties took note of pointed warnings contained in the intelligence community's worldwide threat assessment.
Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats painted a sobering picture of security challenges spanning the globe, calling it a toxic mix.
The scale and scope of the various threats facing the United States and our immediate interests worldwide is likely to further intensify this year. It is increasingly a challenge to prioritize which threats are of greatest importance.
Topping the list, according to Coates, are China and Russia.
China's actions reflect a long-term strategy to achieve global superiority. The Kremlin is stepping up its campaign to divide Western political and security institutions and undermine the post-World War II international order.
Independent Senator Angus King zeroed in on a combined threat.
If those two countries begin to work together systematically, that could be a big problem for us.
With President Donald Trump preparing for another summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, senators wanted to know the extent of Pyongyang's commitment to denuclearization. Responding was Lieutenant General Robert Ashley, director of the Defense Intelligence Agency.
There still is a substantial military capacity that Kim Jong-un wields. 70% of his forces are along the DMZ. So the capabilities and threat that existed a year ago are still there.
As for Iran's compliance with the International Nuclear Accord that President Trump called defective and withdrew from, CIA Director Gina Haspel had this to say.
Technically, they're in compliance, but we do see them debating amongst themselves as they fail to realize the economic benefits they hope for from the deal.
Haspel went on to paint a complicated picture of the Islamic State in Syria, where President Trump has announced a withdrawal of U.S. forces.
They're still dangerous, which is your point, and they're the largest Sunni terrorist group, and they still command thousands of fighters in Iraq and Syria.
In Venezuela's ongoing power struggle, where Washington is backing the opposition over the country's socialist leader, Republican Senator Marco Rubio had a pointed question for Director Coates.
Is it not in the national interest of the United States of America that the Maduro regime fall and be replaced by a democratic and more responsible government?
It's a very fluid situation that I think hopefully will be successfully resolved with the support of the Venezuelan people.
In response, Senator King cautioned against America bringing about regime change in Venezuela, which he described as a slippery slope. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
President Donald Trump took to Twitter Wednesday, appearing to reignite his longstanding feud with the country's intelligence agencies by belittling their assessments on Islamic State, North Korea, and Iran. In a series of posts, Trump claimed responsibility for key improvements while calling out his intelligence chiefs for being extremely passive and naive. Happening now in Asia, Reuters reports the European Union is considering proposals that would effectively amount to a de facto ban on Huawei Technologies Company equipment for next-generation mobile networks. That according to four senior EU officials. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you are with us. Taliban negotiators say the United States has agreed with a militant group to establish technical teams to determine mechanisms for the withdrawal of American and NATO troops from Afghanistan and for preventing terrorists from using Afghan soil against America and its allies. Chief Taliban negotiator Mullah Shir Mohammad Abbas Stanikzai revealed the details after nearly a week of marathon discussions, which concluded on Saturday in Qatar with U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation Zalmay Khalilzad. There was no immediate reaction from the Afghan government or U.S. officials to the assertions made by the Taliban chief negotiator. VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with our Afghanistan reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad about what's known of the talks.
Well, what we know as of this moment is that for the first time, the chief negotiator from the Taliban, Sher Mohammad Abbas Stanikzai, gave an interview today to a pro-Taliban media outlet in which he revealed so many details about his negotiations with U.S. Special Representative for Afghan Reconciliation, Zalmay Khalilzad, that lasted 6 days in Doha, Qatar. And he basically asserted that 2 points that the two sides discussed in Qatar were just that the U.S. would withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, and the Taliban have given assurances that they will not allow anybody to use the Afghan soil for terrorist attacks against America or any of its allies. But the interesting points that he made in his interview were that the Taliban will not sit down with the Afghan government for any peace negotiations because as long as there are foreign forces in the country, Taliban chief negotiator said that there's no reason for them to speak to the Afghan government. And he categorically rejected this administration of President Ashraf Ghani in Kabul as an illegitimate entity and something that has been in place because of the American pressure, military pressure. That shows that the sticking point that Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. envoy, has been pushing for, that there should be a direct dialogue between the Taliban and the Afghan government, is not going to take place, and Taliban is still practically saying that they just want the Americans to withdraw from Afghanistan before any political process takes root in Afghanistan.
What are the Afghan and U.S. officials? What is their reaction?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of concern and confusion among Afghan officials, including President Ghani, because whatever has happened over the past 1 week has been really a surprising development for the government in Kabul. And I think they were not prepared to deal with this kind of a situation. Maybe they were not expecting that the U.S. would make so much progress in the talks with the Taliban. And that is the point which Zalmay Khalilzad highlighted yesterday on Tuesday when he was giving an interview to a local Afghan television station in Kabul. And he acknowledged that while he has made progress in talks with the Taliban, there does not seem to be a consensus among Afghan government officials and leaders in Kabul. They don't know how to carry the peace process forward.
Coming up, other countries are trying to take part in their own peace attempts in Afghanistan. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Your requests, your dedications, and interviews and performances by your favorite music superstars. It's Border Crossings. This is Larry London. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 15 hours Universal Time on VOA or online at voanews.com. You've got control. Border Crossings, weekdays at 15 hours Universal Time at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the China Securities Regulatory Commission says that China has published draft rules for a NASDAQ-style startup board in Shanghai, potentially competing with Hong Kong and New York for listings of tech firms. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. Although U.S. Taliban talks aimed at peace in Afghanistan seem to be holding the upper hand, there are other countries that are trying their own methods and plans for what to do in that country. Michael Kugelman, the deputy director of the Asia program and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, told me about it via Skype.
Russia has in recent months stepped up its role in this whole story. Russia, you know, it's a rival of the United States. It doesn't really like the idea of the U.S. leading these peace efforts. It feels that it should have a role too. And I think that for a while, Russia had the upper hand. Not too long ago in Moscow, the Russians hosted a very significant gathering in which you had Taliban officials at the table with Russians and others, and also a delegation of former officials from India, which is a pretty big deal. And at that point, there was a lot of talk about how the Russians were essentially taking over this peace process in the U.S. And I think the U.S. has wrested it back from the Russians with what's happened in the last few days. But the Russians aren't going away, and I think that it's a mistake for them to try to engage in a parallel process. I think they should try to integrate whatever they've done with this U.S.-led process. I understand that politics and geopolitical rivalries will make that difficult, but you know, let's face it, all of these countries, Russia and the Pakistanis and China, all the regional players that are involved in or have tried to be involved in the peace process, they, generally speaking, all want there to be more stability in Afghanistan, and that requires the war to end, and that should require all these countries trying to put their heads together and work together instead of working at cross purposes.
What about China? Are they in this fight?
Oh, China is very much in this fight. I mean, China, like Russia, has stepped up its game in Afghanistan. It's been trying to deepen its ties to the Taliban in order to be seen as a credible player to help push the Taliban to the table. Beijing has a very clear interest in an end to the war in Afghanistan because it has its Belt and Road Initiative, this huge global infrastructure trade corridor project. And It is intended to pass through Afghanistan, and it'll be very difficult for China to do that so long as you've got a war raging in Afghanistan. So it has a very clear interest in doing what it can to try to bring the Taliban to the table to end the war.
And what has it done?
It's hosted some informal discussions involving the Taliban and some other players. That's been the main thing it's done. You know, China has really kept itself out of the security military realm. There have been some rumors which were essentially dispelled as false that it was trying to build forts and provide weaponry in Afghanistan. I don't think it's doing much of that. For China, its main role is to be more involved in the political process, to launch a peace process. But it certainly is not as involved as the U.S. now, and it's not as involved as the Russians are. But it could play a useful role. China is very close to Pakistan, and Pakistan is seen as a country with a key role in a peace process because of the influence it has over the Taliban. And if the U.S. and others feel that Islamabad is not doing as much as it can to try to coax the Taliban to the table and to continue talking, you know, there could be efforts to try to get China to use its influence in Pakistan to try to get Pakistan to do what it needs to do to keep this process going.
Is it possible that both Pakistan and Afghanistan could become proxy targets as far as the confrontation between Russia, China, and the United States?
Well, I hope it doesn't come to that. And I think that to their credit, the Pakistanis and the Afghans, the governments in both those countries are trying to have relations that are as workable as possible with these countries. Now, for the Pakistanis, they've got very good relations with China. Their relations with Russia have been improving. Their relations with Iran are never going to be as good as their relations with Saudi Arabia, but they're still important to the Pakistanis. Afghanistan is the same way. You know, the Afghan government needs as many friends as it can have in this neighborhood. It has a very historically fraught relationship with Pakistan, but it sought to keep that relationship on an even keel so that the two countries can be in a position to at least try to cooperate on border security. And Afghanistan has pretty good relations, despite the historical baggage, with the Russians, and it's got pretty good relations with the Chinese and the Iranians as well. So I do think that, you know, you could talk about proxy issues, but I do think that luckily in this context, it's not something we have to worry about.
Michael Kugelman, the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. This news alert from VOA Asia, the Radical Islamist Party in Pakistan says it has called on its followers to hold nationwide protest over the weekend after the country's top court this week upheld the acquittal of Asia Bibi, a Christian woman who spent 8 years on death row after being convicted for blasphemy. This is VOA Asia. This past weekend, Pride Week kicked off in full force in Myanmar's largest city, Yangon. A flurry of rainbow umbrellas dotting Yangon Harbor, held by fishermen following a flotilla of partygoers, set sail on Saturday, followed by the Drag Olympics featuring a handbag throwing competition, a stiletto sprint, and a hula hoop contest. Hundreds attended the event, and many traveled from across the country. More now from Libby Hogan in Yangon.
Rainbow flags, stilettos, and a handbag throwing contest. Myanmar's first public LGBT boat parade took to Yangon's waters to celebrate the start of Pride Week.
The reason that I joined this cause, this amazing cause, is because as an actor myself, I've been seeing a lot of misrepresentations in the movies, especially from the gay community or LGBT or trans community. And you know, these people will always depict it as the jokes. So as an actor myself, I'm here to make people think about this.
Hundreds turned out to support the celebrations and watch the Drag Olympics. But off the stage, activists made urgent calls to abolish a law that criminalizes homosexuality. Activist Shin Thant was crowned Miss Transgender winner last year in Myanmar. She hopes to use her fame to draw attention to the cause.
Every man I am meeting with Myanmar parliamentarians, member, and government ministry to change the rules and law and policy.
Shin Thant hopes more events like this one will be held across the country.
This is Science in a Minute.
The U.S. Geological Survey says 71% of the Earth's surface is covered with water. A couple of recent studies have also suggested that there are oceans of water deep inside our planet's mantle. Scientists suggest after its formation about 4.53 billion years ago, Earth was a dry, hot, and molten planet. A heavy bombardment of water and ice-bearing asteroids and comets several million to a billion years later provided the supply of H2O we rely on today. Now, research by a team of geoscientists from Arizona State University proposes another source of Earth's water they say has been overlooked. The sun and planets were formed from a large cloud of gas and dust containing an abundant supply of hydrogen. The study suggests a combination of all that hydrogen, along with Earth's rocky materials, could be the origin of most of our planet's water. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Find us at voanews.com. Our thanks to Tracy Carter, our director, our engineer Zainab Abdelrahman, our managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.